Adams, In and Out of Sports, and this show is always sponsored in part by Horton's Funeral Service, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic Capital Region, and powered by the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. Folks, visit, I repeat, visit for the very best in sports that pertains to the African-American athlete and community. It is the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com, and its founder and my producer, my main man, Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, in the coach's corner this evening is a gentleman that I just have the ultimate respect for. He is what I call a man's man. And I couldn't think of a very more appropriate introduction than the one that I will read, a paragraph from HoyaBasketball.com. If all you know about our guest is one pass late in the game, you've missed a career that ranks among the Big East's best guards. A first-team All-City recruit from Stevenson High School in the Bronx, New York. He's 6'5", was tall for a guard of that era, especially given his quickness and attention to defense. His freshman year was strong from start to finish. He posted a season-high 16 points versus North Carolina in only his second game. He scored 14 points and had 10 assists and a big win over Boston College, and listen to this, scored the winning tip-in in a hotly disputed game at Seton Hall. Our guest started all 32 games as a freshman, finishing first in shooting average, first in assists, and second in steals. And he was named the Big East Rookie of the Year. But his next year, his sophomore year, was even more proficient, leading the Georgetown Hoyas back to the Big East title and on to the NCAA Final Four. Starting all 37 games, he set a single season record with 80 steals, collected 131 assists, and shot 50% from the floor, all at the point guard. Without further ado, from the Bronx, the hottest thing from the Bronx since Mickey Mantle, he is Fred Brown. My man, hey Fred, how you doing, man?
All right, how you doing? You know, statistics can make somebody look good.
Well, look, speaking of making me look good, and I'm going to mess with you just a little bit because we go back like Cadillac seats. Fred Brown, folks, is such a humble guy, and he does things behind the scenes. He doesn't do a lot of interviews, and so I'm honored to get him in the coach's corner tonight. And Fred, man, the one thing that I admired about you was just you were always intense. You were always had the attitude that I will not lose. It's not that you love to win. You hated to lose. Talk about the origin and the foundation of that attitude.
You know, I can't tell you where, I guess, that came from. I mean, I grew up in the youngest of six children, or a youngest boy of six children. I had a sister that was younger than me. But, and so, you know, in the household, we had athletes. My father was a boxer and a musician. So I just think maybe we were all competitive, competing against one another. In the neighborhood we grew up, you know, the Bronx, there was a lot of talent that came out of our area. So you had to wait your turn. And, you know, I think we talked about, I heard Kirk Smith talking about playground playing. Yeah. You know, when you lost, you sat down for the rest of the day. You wasn't getting back out there. You had, when you got your chance to get out there, if you lost, you know, it wasn't like, oh, okay, you're going to get next. You know, it just was, so I think you had to, you know, take pride in trying to win if you wanted to play.
And, you know, every region has its own flavor and takes pride in the history and legacy, D.C., Philadelphia, Baltimore, Detroit, Chicago. But in New York, it's not just New York City ball. It's Harlem, Manhattan, Brooklyn, and then the Bronx. You guys have a style of your own. Talk about New York City basketball, but especially Bronx style. Style basketball.
You know, it's interesting. So, you know, we call it all New York, but like you said, it's really like five different counties that we call in the
right.
Maryland
yeah.
area. But it's very distinct playing styles. And as you become better and you, you know, get selected for certain teams, then you start to play with other people from the different boroughs, and then it becomes New York. But generally speaking, everybody has their like you said, their style. We used to, even within the Bronx, we have projects, right? So
mm-hmm.
within a 15, 20-minute walk, you know, you took five players and went and played against, we call it Castle Hill or Bronx River or Bronxdale. And so we had our own sound. We was there on some Soundview Pride. You know, so, I mean – we've had so many talented, and I didn't notice until later on. I mean, I knew we had talented players, but, I mean, we had really talented players come out of our area all the way back to, I think you had them on your show. Oh, my goodness. I can't
Nate Archibald.
Nate Archibald from Mitchell Projects, but the gentleman who won the first African-American team that played for the NCAA tournament, Texas El Paso, Shed Neville.
That's
you
right.
Know, he actually opened up a recreation center in our community. So when you have somebody like that who played college basketball, won the championship, went to the Boston Celtics, coming back to the neighborhood and giving you some, you know, nuggets of what needs to be done. I mean, they just continued on. What's the young man that plays for, I don't even know if he's from Charlotte no more, Kimber Walker,
mm-hmm.
Kenny Satterfield, all those guys are from the neighborhood, Eddie Pinckney, of course, who played high school with me. So we had a lot of talent just in our community, and that, you know, when you have that amount of talent, you know, it becomes very competitive, and you benefit from playing against one another every day. I mean, we were out in the park 3-4 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course you mentioned the Neville Sheds and the Nate Archibalds. But when I looked at your game, I said, boy, this guy can play. He's my kind of player, but he doesn't play like he's from New York. You didn't have that, or at least when I saw you, Fred, you didn't have that shake and bake and scoop and dupe. You were just so sound fundamentally. You just look like you stepped out of a coach's clinic.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that. I never considered myself, this is the honest truth, I never considered myself a good basketball player. So
wow.
I was very poor growing up, and I could not afford to go to camps. And we had some people in our neighborhood who went to camps. And when they would come back, I'd say, well, show me what y'all did in camp. And, you know, like everything, when people learn something, they may do it for a week once they learn it, and then they go back to their normal. So I would tell the people to show me what they did on camp, and then I'd get up 5 o'clock in the morning, and I'd go out, and I'd be practicing what they showed me. But I continued to practice it year after year, and everything, they continued to grow. So I think that's probably why I became a fundamental player. Because I never considered myself a good athlete. I mean, although, you know, all the things you said are complimentary, but I'm just telling you from my standpoint, I had to work harder because the people I was playing against were far more athletic than I was. I couldn't jump that high. You know, I had quick hands, but I wasn't the fastest guy at 6'5", trying to play against guards. So, you know, I had my challenges, but, you know, I never considered myself a great athlete. And the people I played against were very good. So if I didn't have the fundamentals, I wasn't going to be successful.
But let's go back then. You're in high school in the late 70s, correct?
Uh-huh, 79, 80s when I graduated.
Right, late 70s. And I'm hearing about this guard, Fred Brown, at 6'5". And back then, you didn't have many point guards at 6'5". So talk about how at 6'5", you evolved at the point. Now, you're downplaying your skill set in terms of level of athleticism, but for someone then at 6'5" that could handle the ball the way you could handle it, and here's the key, folks, when youngsters say, well, Coach McAdams, I'm a one, I'm a two, I'm a three, the first thing I ask them, Fred, is, can you guard a one, son? Or young lady, can you guard a two? You could play the one with the ball, but you could also guard a one. How did that develop at 6'5"?
Well, I think what I'm told, you know, that I really shot up one summer. I was, you know, short, and I shot up 6 inches one summer. That's what most of the people in my neighborhood said, that I just shot up. So I guess it was my natural, based on my size and everything else, I, you know, was playing a natural position. And then when I became taller, it just was, you know, a progression that's what my skill set. So interesting enough, like when I went to high school, I went to specialized high school my first year to become a pilot. But I found out that I was colorblind, and so I transferred out of that school because I wasn't going to be able to come up a pilot. It was aviation high school. So I went back to my neighborhood high school. And actually, that's interesting. Dean Smith came to watch us play. We were in the C League, you know what I mean, as an A, B, C. I mean, it was an academic school.
Sure.
And Dean Smith was coming to see three All-Americans that beat us by like 60 points.
Wow.
And I didn't even know who Dean Smith was. He came up to me and said, you are really talented. And I was like, okay, thank you very much. And he gave me his card. And then another guy named Nestor Kaur, who was in the 72 at Stevenson, his brother Roger Kaur was at that game. And he told me, he said, get out of this school, transfer out of the school back to the neighborhood. And that's when my father came home. I transferred back to the school and realized that I had talent to play basketball. But my freshman year, I was really more interested in academics and you know, profession, worrying about what I was going to do after high school.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of the people that, and you had mentioned the Nate Archibalds and the Neville Sheds, but who were some of the other people that influenced your game, both in the neighborhood and maybe on television?
You know, the people I influenced my game, people wouldn't even know. But so I played with a team called the Pacers in New York. And so my brother Glenn was the first basketball player in our family. We really were baseball. My brother Buster was a pretty good baseball player. He was the oldest. And my brother Kevin, who was 1 year under Glenn, the third brother. They were really talented athletes in other sports. Glenn started playing basketball, and he played with this team called the Pacers. Now, Stanley Lamb, you might remember, he played Taboo, Jerry Lewis, Kevin Stott, Tony Lawson. So these are guys who were really talented and who, you know, we went to watch play, and they had a fight. Listeners, like every game they played, there was a fight. And I tell you, every game, there was a fight. So that's us younger guys, when we started playing, just when we started doing, we play ball and we fight. You know what I'm saying? So I didn't really watch college basketball. I never really watched TV, so I wasn't influenced by, the players and the pros and things of that nature. I had an opportunity to watch Charlie Scott play in Rucker when he hit like 52 points.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going to see him play. But just the people in my neighborhood, really, I was really limited. You know, we grew up in an environment such that if you didn't have all your boys with you, you didn't leave your neighborhood.
Wow.
You know, I hate to say it, but that's the way it was.
Now,
and
was this the South Bronx? Was this the South Bronx?
Yeah, the South Bronx, right.
Okay.
We call it
okay.
The Soundview community, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, I probably was in high school before I started. venturing off. I was asking Dave McCullough. You had him on your show, the Gaucho Show coach.
That's right.
And he, I asked him, like, how did I don't even remember how I became a Gaucho. And he's from the neighborhood. And he went to Stevenson when they won his first championship. And he said he came to see me play. I was the first high school player he ever came to see play. And somebody told him my brother, he knew my brother. And then he said his younger brother's good. And he came and he talked to Mr. Post, apparently. And I guess that's how I became a Gaucho. I never remembered, but I was blessed. Because the Gaucho, Billy Goodwin, I played on the same team. Pete Aguilar, Darren Barnett went to Columbia. I mean, we had a Richie Adams that went to UNLV.
Yeah,
we had
one
of the best you know, what they call AAU now. We had one of the best teams ever. I mean, really talented people.
Talk about that. That's an excellent point. Talk about how the traveling teams then versus the traveling teams AAU now. And I know that in your transition from a player, you were a coach. So talk about what you observed when you were coaching and from a distance now versus when you were a player.
Well, the main difference was, I mean, the people who were traveling, I mean, we went to Hawaii 6 times in 1 year. You know, we really went to Russia. We went to Yugoslavia. So what I would say about that, you really had to be very good to be on the team that traveled. You know what I'm saying? So you had 12, 15 really good players. Now AAU is everybody can go play, you know, and travel from – you know, state to state, things of that nature. They're not doing the time to travel we were doing. We were international playing against Russia, playing, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one big difference. And the other difference is that, you know, you are loyal to your program. Now one kid play with one team, he ain't playing enough minutes, he going to play with another team if he jumped to another team. That didn't happen with us. We, you know, you were a Gaucho, you're a Gaucho. You play with us, you play with us, and you took pride in your program and in competing against those other programs and other people on the teams and stuff like that. And I think as you leave high school, you know, and you start playing, or when you're in high school and you become talented, those people that you competed against, you know, are now on your team, and y'all are representing the city of New York City together. You talked about the different boroughs breakdown, but once you become really talented, now you're representing the whole city, because it doesn't matter if you're from the Bronx, Brooklyn, Manhattan, Queens, whatever. You're part of New York. You're part of the one team, and you know, then you go compete against other states. So we would represent New York City, all of us. Right now, you may have 40 teams representing the region of certain regions of New York.
Yeah, yeah.
It's totally different than what it was when I was coming along.
Fred Brown is in the coach's corner. And Fred, as we stated earlier, you were a high school All-American. You had Dean Smith giving you cards. So let's talk about the recruiting process. I mean, obviously you ended up going to Georgetown, but what other schools were on your short list, and why did you choose the Hoyas, Georgetown University?
So, yeah, I narrowed it down to 4 schools. You were allowed 6, but I didn't really, like you said, I'm a I didn't like all of the fanfare, and so I just selected 2 big schools and 2 schools. So, as you said, I was a big point guard. So Michigan State, Magic had just graduated. They were really recruiting me hard. Ohio State was number 1 in the country. They had Clark Kellogg and a very talented group of people. So those are 2 big schools that I selected. And then 2 small schools was Georgetown and Duke. And that's when Duke had Mike Stinsky, Gene Banks, Vince Carter. They had the group of players, too. And, you know, I really was interested. So the other part of it is 2 very strong academic schools. I'm not saying Michigan State and Ohio State wasn't strong academically, but they were really big schools, you know, 50,000 students. So I was always interested in academics, and I just could not see myself sitting in the classroom watching a teacher or a professor on the screen and try to do work. So that kind of narrowed it down to two schools. And then that was Coach K's first year actually getting the job. But here's what happened. When they were recruiting me, Coach Fisher was still the head coach. So Coach K was doing all the talking to me when I visited. You know, you stay over for 48 hours. And I'm like, okay, well, why would I come to school and the head coach is not even getting talking to me, you know? And I got to back up. Like, Michigan State, when I visited Michigan State, they said that Jed Heathcote, the coach, never talked to his players. He said, after practice is over, you'll never see him. He doesn't have a word for you, anything else. So that was like on my radar. You know, you're learning as you go on. So now I'm at Duke visiting, and the head coach is not talking to me. I'm like, oh, this is a problem. Unbeknownst to me, they had not announced that Coach K was getting the head coaching job. It wasn't official. He knew it, but it wasn't official, so they didn't let me know it. So that was a problem for me. So, and then the other main component of it, when I visited Georgetown, I wanted to play for a black coach. I thought he would understand my plight as an African-American young man coming out of the inner city. And Washington, D.C. was just beautiful. I mean, physically, the population, the culture, I just fell in love with it. So it was actually an easy decision.
Mm-hmm. And during the introduction, as we stated, you had a fantastic freshman season. But to get to that point, talk about some of the transitions you had to make off the court and especially on the court.
So this is the true challenges that I face. They have a community scholars program for Georgetown. So if you were coming to the school, and unless you were really had like unbelievable SAT scores and great things, they helped you come in the summertime to make a transition from the environment you come into an environment like Georgetown, not just academically, but socially, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it was the summertime. I'm here maybe about a week, and we're about a block outside the school. And so the police started, the sirens started going and all. And I took off. I was gone. They're like, what the hell is wrong with you? I was like, dude, man. And I hear that stuff. I know this is not the place I need to be. I was out of there. So that's the kind of transition I had to make. You know what I mean? I wasn't really exposed to a whole lot of white people. And white people come from influence. You know, they had, you know, a background that was very different than I was. Had so it was a challenge. I tell you, going to Georgetown, coming from the environment I came, was not easy.
And contrary to what some people may think, as you know, your assistant coach Mike Riley is like a brother, a longtime friend. And we had a conversation recently, and he was saying that when he was a student athlete there, someone saw him and said, "Oh, you're at Georgetown. What you studying? Physical education?" And he said, "No." And, you know, we don't have physical education curriculum at Georgetown. You know, talk about the time that you had, because now you've got two demanding factors. You have a demanding basketball routine because you're playing in the Big East, but also you have a very demanding academic routine. How did you balance the two?
Well, interesting. I'll tell you a story. That same community scholars program. So it's not only challenging from, you know, a lot of people look at athletes in a particular way. And so even African-American kids that were in the program with me and minorities had, you know, looked at. I remember Arnie Russell.
Yes.
Arnie Russell was at the school with us for a good 2 or 3 weeks before he was let go. And so he conducted himself one way that represented an athlete, maybe not in the best light. Then I'm conducting myself in a different way, trying to show that I was a student athlete. And I remember doing a paper that summer. We had to write a paper, and I turned in my paper. And the professor tried to, you know, in front of everybody, was like, "You didn't write this." And I was like, what are you talking about? You know, he said, this is an excellent paper and stuff like that. You didn't write this. And I was like, okay, I did write it. So I went down to Coach Thompson and told him what had transpired and all. And needless to say, that gentleman wasn't there at the university anymore. But so those are the challenges you have in that regard. People thinking, you know, because you're an athlete, you don't have intelligence or skills or capabilities. But I also say that I think I was a fairly good student coming out of high school. But I don't think just on alone I would have got into a school like Georgetown. So my first year, I may have had C's and D's, but, you know, like any competitive person, by the time I was left Georgetown, I was a student. So, you know, I struggled learning a different, you know, it's like my daughter went to the University of Pennsylvania. You know, there's a different level. You know, you're talking about people who never really had to get a tutor and things of that nature. They all were the brightest of the brightest. And so it's a transition. Even though I was a good student, there are students who are good students, got a better fundamentals in terms of academics, better disciplines. And so my time, while people were going to the parties and hanging out, I was in the library studying. I didn't have a good social life at Georgetown because it was hard for me academically, and I wanted to do well.
Now talk about the transition from high school basketball to not just – Division One, but to the Big East, man.
So, I didn't really know much about the Big East. I saw Georgetown play Madison Square Garden for the first time, probably my first time ever seeing a college game, and they were down like 8 or 9 points with 50 seconds to go, and they ended up winning it. So, like you said earlier, I'm a defensive guy. I took pride in shutting people down, and that how many points I hit on a person. I wanted to play against the best person who was, you know, the offensive machine, and I took pride in shutting him down. And play the zone on my side of the court, you was not going to score if I had anything to do with it. So Georgetown, back then, that's what they were playing, awesome defense. So that's kind of the first experience I had with Big East. A lot of people prior to that went to the Big Ten. You know, like I said, Ohio State, Michigan State. That was the program. The Big East was just like getting, you know, coming along. And a lot of people stayed in New York. They usually would go away. Or St. John's, they would go away and come back. So I was part of that transition. And again, I didn't really – for me, this is what I would say. Whether I played in the Boys Club, I played in high school, I played at Georgetown, in the Big East. They were all the same thing, it was a rectangle. I didn't play no different in none of those environments. They all were the same. I just played the same way all the time. That's the only way
Fred,
I knew
that's
I played.
A great point that I want our listeners across the area and across the country to hear. One of the things that I admired so much about you was that regardless of what the situation was, whether you were playing great, whether you make a mistake, whether you were winning your team, you were losing, you always kept your composure. And again, let us know what's the foundation of that. And you were able to carry that same disposition into the bigger game, the game called life. But your expression never changed. Talk to us about that.
Well, I think at a very early age, like I wanted to go to Harvard. I brought a briefcase when I was like in sixth grade that I knew I was going to, you know, have when I went to college and in the business world. So My ambition really was not sports. My ambition was to, you know, become a I don't know when to say a millionaire. It was really to be a father, to be a person who wanted to represent the black community in a certain way. And so it's just something that I took pride in and wanted to be seen, like a lot of times people want to look at you as a dumb athlete or stereotype you in a certain way. It's not something that I wanted. I wanted to let people know that you could play athletics and be intelligent and respectful to people. And, you know, I never jumped in. We had at Georgetown in many places, because we had certain practices, you could go to the front of the line in the cafeteria. You didn't have to wait. And I never would go in the front of the line. I stayed in the line with the people and stuff like that. And so people noticed that kind of stuff, you know. So I always just was trying to say I'm a student just like you. I'm a human being just like you. And so I try to carry myself in that way. I don't know what more to say about that.
No, that was well said. Now, I just finished watching probably for like the sixth or seventh time, the 30 for 30 documentary on the Bad Boys, the Detroit Pistons. And then in football, you had the Oakland Raiders. Well, back in the 80s, Georgetown, you guys were the Pistons before the Bad Boys. You were right there with the Raiders. Talk to us about Hoya paranoia. What is it? And I know you guys and Coach Thompson, you loved it, you fed off it. But tell our listeners, man, what was Hoya paranoia?
Well, you know, I think it took a life on itself. I think, like today, you know, the media has a lot of influence on how they present different teams. And, you know, we had a black coach. We were pretty much, I mean, my freshman year, we had three white kids on the team. But then we ended up becoming an all-African-American team, and we played a certain style. And so, you know, all those, you know, Hoya paranoia and things of that nature, I mean, it took a life on itself. But I think what happened was, like I said, if you even go back to prior to me coming, I mean, it was a style of play that Georgetown, we were in your face for the entire game. You know, we had so many variations of defense, and we could switch in and out of them so quickly. It was very confusing to people. And then, you know, like I said, the environment I came from, out of the Bronx, and we were no-nonsense. We were ready to fight in a heartbeat. Patrick came out of the environment, out of Boston, and, you know, we had Reggie and David Wingate that came out.
Now, don't forget my main man, and we're going to talk about it because I know you were a mentor with him. But, you know, you mentioned, of course, yourself and Patrick and the Baltimore guys. But the finishing touch, to me, the finishing touch, the Hoya paranoia was my man, the enforcer, Mike Graham.
Tell you a funny story, Butch. So,
yes.
Right before the championship game, it was the semifinal game. We played Kentucky, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Mike Graham and Ralph Dalton, they you know, we had a lot of competition against one another. Gene Smith against Fred Brown, Michael Graham against what's his name?
Ralph Dalton.
Mm-hmm. And so they got into a huge fight. And so there was a side that represented Patrick, and those guys represented Ralph. And then there was the younger kids, Reggie, David, Michael, Graham, and them, and it represented. And so it was like a big tension. And Coach Thompson had to call off the practice, you know, because it was like, I mean,
This was right before or during the March Madness tournament?
Yeah, this is the Final Four. This is the championship, the semifinal game. This is the practice before the game. That's how intense we played. Our practices were so intense against one another. When we went out to play many other teams, it was like it was nothing.
Wow. And I bet you – and you know this being a coach later, but I know Coach Thompson loved it because he probably turned to his assistants, Craig Escherich and the aforementioned Mike Riley, and said, "We ready."
Oh, yeah.
And talking about practice and defense, you know – you just don't show up on game day or game night and press people from baseline to baseline. You got to get in shape. Talk, what was the endurance, the drills, the suicides? What was that like in practice for Georgetown to prepare you to play that defense? Take our listeners through a typical Georgetown practice.
Well, you know, I try to teach kids this day that trying to, you know, go in the work world. So we had to practice. We had to be there at 4:30. 4:30 meant you were on the floor ready to go at 4:30. You wasn't coming in the door at 4:30. So everybody had to be taped. So you had to see Miss Michaels, who was the trainer. We had our own trainer. And so you had to go get taped and do all those things. And then you could work on your individual skills maybe like 15 to 20 minutes prior to practice. You couldn't come down any earlier because they wanted you to get your academics in. So you go through the whole stretching and everything else, and then once he blows that whistle, he points. He didn't tell you nothing. He just pointed. We had a series of drills that we automatically went through to loosen up. And then, you know, the beautiful thing was staged. Like with our defense, we went one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three, then you jumped into the full court. But each of the building blocks, you did the same thing every single day. So people don't realize if you change defenses or you change offense every year, your whole team becomes freshmen every year. So it was a thing where you continually, each year, the older guys teaching the younger guys, and, you know, it's the same thing over and over again and stuff like that, and you could put nuances in it. But like I said, the thing about our practices was very intense. And, you know, he knew Coach Thompson, like any good coach, knows how much you need to run to get in shape to bring you along slowly to get you to the peak at the right time. But afterwards, after our practice, we had what they call, we don't call them suicides because they had outlawed it, but line the lines. And so everybody had to shoot foul shots. And so he knew how much he was going to make you run anyway. So sometimes you would go through a series of two people, you know, we shot foul shots two or three times, long as we got the running in that he wanted us to get in. So it was like if we didn't do a whole lot of running in the practice, at the end we were going to make it up in the running. Or if we did a lot in the practice, then he might not do as much at the end. So it was a consistency and a building up of your endurance so to get you ready. But, again, it was intense. When you have that kind of talent playing against each other, it was very intense.
What was it like as we continue our conversation in the coach's corner with Fred Brown? What was it like playing for a coach like John Thompson, a brilliant man, a strong black man, but very demanding, and could speak in tongues, and especially you being the point guard and being the coach on the floor? How were you able to have the thick skin where some of the things, how Coach said it, you tuned it out, but you listened to his directives? Talk to us about that.
Okay.
Can you hear me? Yeah, now I can, yes, thanks.
So when I first came to Georgetown, I mean early, you know, preseason, there was a situation that happened. I can't even tell you what the situation was, but Coach Thompson, you know, as you say, he had a way of delivering himself. You know, he cussed a lot. And so afterwards, I went up to the practice and I told him, you know, I said, you don't never need to curse at me again. I said, all you need to do is tell me what you want me to do and I will get it done. But don't never curse at me again. And so we had a mutual understanding, you know, that that's not what you needed to do. The productivity out of me. I understand that that's his way. He grew up with his father doing such and such. So we had an understanding. I love playing for him. I love the intensity. I mean, it was the right choice for me. What I wanted to get out of it, somebody who represented on and off the court the right way and with a lot of respect. The players who come out of his program and the success they've had, you know, in basketball and outside of basketball, but most importantly about life. So for me, I thought it was an awesome opportunity to go to a school like Georgetown, get a good education, play for an African-American coach who had success in his own life. It was awesome. Yeah.
And of all the players, of course, Patrick and Alonzo and Mutombe and Allen Iverson, on and on, but I can't think of any player that was more of a reflection of a coach. And they say that sometimes players can become a reflection of their coach. You were a reflection of Coach Thompson, different demeanor, a little different way to get your point across, but both very dignified black men, very intelligent black men who took a great amount of pride in your blackness. And I think that when you look at the Georgetown program, you're one of the first players that come to mind, Fred Brown.
Well, you know, I remember going to talk to Coach Thompson after my freshman year. I didn't really socialize with the other guys on the team, and I sat by myself in the dining room. And, you know, I had it was an adjustment for me. And so Coach Thompson came to me and talked to me. He's like, well, what other school are you interested in? You know, maybe this ain't the right place for you and stuff like that. And I told him, I said, well, you know, I'm fine with not playing ball. I just want to get an education, though. I don't, you know, I said, let me explain it to you. I said, basketball is my only way out of the environment I grew in. I've never seen anybody make it out of it through sports. And he said to me at that time, he said, well, I hope, and this was the last we had a conversation, he said, I hope by the time you graduate out of here, you see that differently, you know? I mean, my exposure wasn't to a whole lot of people being successful outside of athletics. That was the vehicle, so, you know. And the only way I was going to be able to stay at Georgetown or to get a scholarship was to play academics. So, I was blessed to be able to play for somebody like him, learn from him. I loved sitting anytime he drove places. And as a team, I would try to sit in the car. You know, I was one of those people who stole knowledge. I just sat and listened to what people said and listened to how they said it, what they were saying, and then I applied it to my life. So definitely a big role model in my life. I mean, it really helped me to be the person I am.
Okay, now, this is important, so get close to the phone because you're giving us some great information. What was your impression the first time you saw, in my opinion, one of the top five or six greatest college basketball players of all time, Patrick Ewing? I mean, anytime, Fred, you lead your team 3 out of 4 years to a championship game, that says something. Pat Ewing
right.
was awesome. When you first saw him, did you say, oh, boy, you know, where's my championship ring, or it's just a matter of time? Or when you said, I don't know if he's as good as they're building him up to be?
You when you see him play for the first time, I mean, it's pretty fascinating. I remember from seeing him playing against Ed Spriggs and Coach Thompson looking at the other assistant coaches and just laughing because it was, like, phenomenal what he was able to do. So, no, it wasn't when it's like watching Allen Iverson play. And I coached him in the summer league. And when you see greatness, it's, you know, it's not like, wow, he's not living up to the expectations that people expect. He was phenomenal right from the beginning.
Wow. And talking about phenomenal, two phenomenal seasons, 82 season, 84 season, both teams go to the finals. 82, you come up just a little short. 84, you win it all. Talk to us about those two teams. And if you were to, you know, an old college expression in your English course, compare and contrast those two teams, 82 versus 84.
82 team was a better team athletically. 82 team was a better team defensively, 82 team would have beat 84 team, I believe, because we would have shut them down. But 84 team was more offensive minded. They wasn't as good as defense. They were good defense, but not as good as a defensive as the 82 team. So you got a crossover of players. Patrick was on both teams. I was on both teams. The people who were not were Sleepy Floyd, Eric Smith, Mike Hancock, Ed Spriggs. So you take Sleepy, and compare him and Michael, Reggie Williams. You know, Reggie Williams, 6'9", and an offensive machine. David Wingate was an unbelievable defense. Dave Wingate's probably the closest thing you'll get to Sleepy Floyd, because Sleepy played both center offense.
Right.
He couldn't shoot as good as Sleepy, but he still could score on you and could blow by you. Both were very good teams, but I had to give the edge to the 82 team just because of the tenacity that we brought on defense.
I've heard a couple of people say that you really can't become a man. You know how this in certain cultures, a boy transitions into manhood when he has to go through certain rituals. And I heard a sports guy say, well, in order to be a man, you got to watch the Washington football team and versus the Dallas Cowboys. And you got to watch the Georgetown game versus North Carolina. That was arguably the greatest game played with so many, not just pros, but Hall of Famers. What was it like being on the court with Patrick Ewing, Michael Jordan, James Worthy? I mean, on and on and on, Fred. What was that like? I mean, most of us can only dream of that. You lived it.
Well, I tell you that particular game. So you know, as you come out of the locker room and you're playing in those really big arenas, we run through a tunnel. And I remember Earl Pearl, Magic Johnson, and Dr. J, I think, was there standing at the tunnel. So when we were coming out, it's like, wow, they're coming to see us play. We have arrived. That's what feeling I was. Wow. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing I saw. Now, remember, again, I said to you that all the courts to me are all the same. Once you're on the court, I don't care who you're playing against, I play the same way. So I never really, at the time while I was going through it, thinking, because most of my high school and, career was playing against great talent. So I never said, oh, wow, Michael Jordan's playing or James Worthy. To me, they were just two other college players. Or, you know what I'm saying? Now, Matt Doherty and I had played against one another for the state championship in New York, so I knew Matt Doherty. And so, of course, I wanted to do well against him. But, yeah, in hindsight, you look at it now and you say, wow, I played against and played with some really talented people. Most of those teams had four or five players go to the NBA. That's pretty awesome.
But now you say that a court is a court, a game is a game, but it has to be a difference in shooting in a gymnasium versus a football stadium. I mean, that has to be more of a difficult challenge in terms of the what they call the background and the depth of it. Shooting in a dome has to be difficult, or it's a tremendous adjustment.
Well, what I would say is, though, so remember, we played Syracuse every year Syracuse. And that's a dome.
That's right.
So, and then we played in Madison Square Garden three or four times that year. So for me, and the other thing is what Georgetown did was unique back then, that you got to give Coach Thompson did some unique things. Georgetown, every time we played, they actually we went 2 days before and to get acclimated to the environment and things of that nature. So we kind of acclimated ourselves to, you know, wherever we were going to play. So I didn't, again, really, and again, at that time I started, after my freshman year, I already started become a distributor and not a shooter. So hold on a second, Butch. I'm sorry.
All right. As we continue our conversation with Fred Brown, talking Georgetown and college basketball and the game of life, and it's quite interesting. Fred Brown is on our newsmaker line. And Fred, you guys come up short, but talk about a priest who are near and dear to my heart as well as yours, gave a tremendous sermon one Easter. And the theme of that sermon was, and I've never forgotten it, and I've always repeated it, some defeats are more triumphant than victory. And what he meant by that was sometimes you have to go through something to build up to become who you're supposed to be. You and the team have a very disappointing loss to North Carolina, but you come back two seasons later and win it all. How much did that disappointing loss aid you in winning that championship?
Everything was preparation for the next step. So, you know, you've heard the saying that some people are just excited about being there.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, and so, hold on a second.
All right, Fred Brown is in the coach's corner. And, folks, hey, just stay with us, because tomorrow in the coach's corner, we don't stop. We bring the legends in for you. Tomorrow we will have two members of a legendary Dunbar Baltimore team, 1973, the historic game that put Baltimore basketball on the map. We will have Timmy Green, the power forward on that team, and one of the greatest high school players of all time, Skip Honey Dip Wise. So stay with us. And then the following week, oh boy, we've got them lined up. Hall of Fame sports writer, NBA David Aldridge, will join us and much, much more in the Coach's Corner. And every show is brought to you by Horton's Funeral Service. They are located 600 Kennedy Street Northwest. If you have a family member or friend in need of any funeral care, give them a call, 202-829-9000. That's 202-829-9000. And ask for Randolph Horton, a.k.a. Reds Bowman. And also, if you are in need of any dental care, hey, I've got a guy for you. He's the best. That's Dr. Edward T. Buford. He's on U Street right next to Ben's Chili Bowl. So you get your teeth fixed or clean, then you go next door, say hello to Kamal and the Ali family and get your chili dog. But the number to Dr. Edward T. Buford is 202-667-8818. All right, Fred, are you back?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I'm sorry. And, yeah, I'm glad you got Skip Wise coming out. I met him. He's a good guy. I heard so much about him. I was pleased to meet him. So back to the 82 losing and then preparation. So I think that you benefit in anything you do in life, right? If you have an opportunity to participate in something, you learn from the experience, and it helps you when you're competing against people that's doing it for the first time, or, you know, haven't had the experience, it, you know, you have an advantage. So I think that we learned that And there's some people who are just happy to, Coach Andrew, so they say this, we don't want to be happy that we made it to the championship. We want to win the championship.
That's right.
But at the end of the day, you don't win. You have to be happy that you were amongst the top schools in the country. But what did you learn from it to help you to come back to be successful in your next endeavor? And so, of course, I think that the things we learned being there, there's a lot of distractions when you get to that Final Four level that mess a whole lot of people up. Coach Hunter used to say, it's not when you lose you got to be worried about it. It's when you win. You got to manage winning. And so a lot of people, those highs and lows, they can't manage them. And so, you know, if you're a team that I think we went, 31-1 or 31-3 or something like that that year. So if you don't know how to manage losing and being able to come back after that adverse situation, you know, that's a life lesson there too. So the benefits of being able to participate in those games. And think about it, we lost by 1 point, and, you know, all the goaltending calls they had and things of that nature, I mean, that was a phenomenal game, you know.
Yeah.
Good teams competing, and, you know, one team's going to have to lose. I mean, that's just the way it is. We have
and, Fred, here's a great quote, again, from HoyaBasketball.com. From you, I hate to lose, okay, but
mm-hmm.
I can't let this affect my life, and to your credit, it didn't. Now, let's talk about how you dealt with adverse situations. You have a knee injury that slows you down, but going back to the mindset that you have expressed several times during this interview, that you did not look at yourself just as an athlete. You are a student athlete. And so while you had the injury, it slowed you down on the court, but it certainly did not slow you down academically.
You know, and when you talk about mindset, one thing I would say that I really was conscious of is that I wanted an education, that I was a student, and that it was very important for me, regardless of what happened on the court, that I needed to get an education. I needed to learn. I needed to have the skills, thinking skills necessary to go on in life. Well, and the sad thing about kids, they think, oh, I'm going to make it to the NBA. If you make it to the NBA, you play 20 years. You still got 60 more years to live, you know. So if you don't have an education, you don't have thinking capability, what are you going to do? So I had a mindset that was very important to get an education. That was very important to me. But I also wanted to succeed as an athlete. So the two things that I concentrated was athletics and academics. Those were my two concentrations. And, you know, other things had to sacrifice. I had sacrificed other things to do that, and I was fine with that.
You know, earlier I said that you were the epitome of the Georgetown basketball program. When you first walk in Coach Thompson's office, you would see the basketball that was deflated, and it was symbolic of what are you going to do when the ball doesn't bounce. Well, man, you hit the ground running. You go into the corporate world. You work for Xerox, make a ton of money, looking like you just stepped out of GQ. Talk about how the ups and downs and the tough practices at the Big East level prepared you for the work world and especially the corporate world.
Yeah, I tell kids, you know, it's a fascinating thing. While when we were at Georgetown, we never went home for Christmas, Thanksgiving. I mean, we practiced. We had sometimes two-a-day practices. We had to get up 5 in the morning to practice. Then we had to come back at 4:30. I mean, he was no joke about that. And I actually love practice, so it didn't faze me one bit.
Hey, Fred, Fred Coach used to say during the holidays, he'd come in and say, Merry Christmas to all and to all wall to wall.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, and isn't that it's interesting. Like, I hired a guy recently, 28-year-old guy, and he had to have his 2 days off. I mean, sometimes it had to be in the middle of the week. I mean, I'm like, what? How do you only have $200 in your bank account, but you got to have 2 days off? You know, so, again, a mindset. The awesome thing about athletics and playing for a program like Georgetown was you develop a work ethic. You know what I mean? You had to, you know, you had to come and compete. You had to get sleep. I mean, he was a master at that stuff, you know. Like, people go hang out at night. Well, you couldn't go hang out on a Friday night because we had serious, you know, early morning, but you had to be there. So how could you hang out and come to practice, you know? I mean, he was just the thing that he did was phenomenal in terms of his structure and things of that nature that helped you in, as you say, in life. I mean, you know, develop a work ethic, develop the, you know, you're not going to have success all the time. The highs and lows, being able to manage it. You know, I was in sales, so, you know, you start spending your money before you get it. And then you don't get the sales. But that's, you know, you're defeated, you know, you feel that way. But athletics help you to work through it, you know. It's part of what you do. You go out, you give it your all. If you're successful, great, you get the sale. If you're not, you can go on to the next deal. So athletics was really helpful for me in the business world.
And then, of course, corporate world, but you still have that basketball itch, and you become a coach and one of the top coaches in the country. And the one thing, Fred, that when you were a coach, I always admired mostly was that, boy, you had an eye for talent, man. I mean, you could spot a player from a mile away and then, of course, develop that player. But talk about your career as a basketball coach.
Yeah, you know, again, to the bigger picture, I wrote down the 31 kids that I recruited to Episcopal, and all of them went to on to college. Most of them played for some very good programs. It's like 9 of them are multimillionaires. And, you know, one of the things that their parents that I'm in relationships with, they call me and tell me, you know, they laugh all the time and say, Coach Brown, this, because they understand that they had to get up in the morning and go work out. You know, we were in a boarding school, so it was different. We couldn't have 5 o'clock in the morning practices and stuff like that. And so, but to me, the joy of coaching the kids is not necessarily the basketball part of it, but now in life they are doing well. So they use basketball as the carrot. I use basketball as the carrot to develop the relationship and try to shape and mold the kids to help them understand what is most important in life. And I just, right before the holidays, you know, I had gotten a job, you know, at the recreation center. I was going to do basketball, train the kids. And, you know, I'm old school in a lot of ways. I want to go back to the fundamentals. I mean, I just think it's important. These kids don't want to understand the fundamentals. Everybody wants to throw the three-point shot. But, you know, basketball is an exciting and fun game if you play it the right way.
Last two questions, man. You know, this is just so informative here. Fred Brown, Georgetown fame in the coach's corner. And, Fred, what are some of the things you look at the game today? What are some of the things that you like? What are some of the things that you don't like?
I don't like the parental involvement. When I was coming along, you know, our parents had to work all the time, 2 and 3 jobs. They never saw us play. So I do like a mixture of it, but the parents are involved in so much. And, you know, as a coach, or, you know, you're pushing the kid and you're trying to develop them, and the parents see that. They see it as they see it from their adult eyes, and we kind of get in the way of you developing the kids. So that's one thing that really disturbs me. And then the work ethic of the kids. I was looking up for the school. I ain't going to mention their name, a good friend of mine. And I volunteered to train the kids. I said, if you want to come in someday, I can show you some things. And I showed this kid some dribbling skills. And I said, okay, great. They do it in place. I said, now go down and back, you know, to the baseline and back. He said, all the way down, man. I stopped talking. I said, talk to me. He truly did not want to go down. I said, when you play basketball, don't you go down and back? He said, that's a dream. We're prisoners. So that's
wow. That's,
and then you got some kids, unfortunately, the less talented kids got the drive and the determination, but they don't have the athleticism. You know, so it's nice that you can find some kids that have the mixture of the two that want to learn, don't want to be pampered, don't, you know, it's not all about points. Everybody thinks it's all about points. I don't like that. You know, it's like, it's more like you said, basketball, there's defense, there's pass, there's so many things around sports that you can use to be successful. You know, so many jobs. Everybody wants to be a basketball player, and nobody wants to be a Butch McAdams or James Brown. You know what I'm saying? There's so many other statistics.
Sure.
There's so many other things you can do around sports. Just use it to get an education, a free education, so that you can go on and be successful in life.
And now, speaking of that, Fred, and some of our listeners may not be aware, but you started off in broadcasting and did a great job.
Yeah, I worked with Warner Wolf. I had, again, just like with sports, I had no idea who he was, but we did a game together, and he came up to me and he said, I don't know what profession you're in, but this is the profession you should be in. And I never pursued it, and I should have. I just didn't. There were some aspects of it I didn't like. At the time,
such as, just briefly, such as.
Well, you know, when you work with the people you work with and you're color commentating, they have to bring you in and you get it. You got to get out, right?
Right.
So if that person is like, it's like in athletics, right? If you got a point guard that's not in sync with their second guard, then you're not going to be successful. And so I didn't care much for the people that were, you know, play-by-play, and so I just didn't pursue it. But I should have. I actually should have. Not, again, something that you have a passion for, something I know the game, you know, I think I could bring a different insight to it, but I just never pursued it.
Well, that's what you've done. That's what you've done during this interview, is bring a different insight and taking us truly inside the locker room of Georgetown and big-time college basketball. Last question, and throughout the interview, the theme has been to get your education, get that degree. But now, what about the talented young man, 18 years old, destined to be a professional player?
Mm-hmm.
You a counselor. Would you tell, if he had the opportunity, would you tell him to go to school or go to the NBA and get the money and pursue his passion and his career? Now, I'm not talking about people who think. I'm talking about the LeBron James, the Zion Williamsons of the world.
I think each situation is unique to that individual and what they bring to the table. So I do think it's on an individual basis. I don't think college, when I say education, I don't think college is for everybody. So that, I'm not saying education in that regard. That used to be the vehicle that I believe that you had to take in order to do some things. But there's many different forms of education. But the thing that is the challenge that young kids have to understand is, in college, it is a profession, it's a business, but you're kind of I don't want to say in a cocoon, so you're protected in a lot of ways, and so it gives you some time to mature. In the NBA, that is, you know, you are dealing with the best, the prettiest girls, the connivingest people, you know,
no,
the shops that want your money, And so you coming in as a young person and you don't have that foundation, you could get lost in the source of drugs, that, you know what I mean, all those things that could bring you down. So you have the talent, but do you have the other things necessary, successful to, you know, maintain? So I think it's an individual basis. I mean, LeBron James has done a phenomenal job with it. So, I mean, you know, you look at him, and I don't know some of the younger kids and who they're feeling anymore, but so it's an individual choice. I don't think going to college, everybody should go to college. But the other part of it is, too, about college is, you know, you can buy insurance from Lloyds of London and things of that nature to protect your career if you get hurt and things of that nature. So, I mean, you gotta look at the total picture and what it is you're trying to do and what your skills allow you to do. And I'm not talking about basketball skills, but your maturity level and your capability to socialize and discipline to stay away from all that stuff. And it's hard. So, you know, maybe an 18-year-old, 19-year-old going to the NBA, it's, whoa, you know, it's tough.
Yeah, it's tough.
And a multimillionaire.
Yeah. Fred, we've got a minute and a half left. We always ask our guests to leave our listeners with a parting shot. We call it wow, words of wisdom. Who better than Fred Brown? You've got it.
I just say that, you know, athletics is very important at an early age. I think everybody should participate in some form of athletics, but not just to be the talent, but to use it in any way they can to learn all the other attributes associated with being successful in life, being a good human being, being a good parent, being a good sibling. And I think through athletics you can do all those things. And it's just for younger people, it's a great springboard to, you know, take you to wherever you, whatever height you want it to reach.
Well, as I said at the beginning, Fred Brown, you're a man's man. You do so much for so many people behind the scenes. People would just be amazed to know what you do for so many. But you continue. And as I said, man, I love you. And we've been friends for well over 30-some years. And every time we're together, whether we're eating dinner or watching a game or just talking, I've never had a bad day with Fred Brown. Hey, Fred, thanks,
right,
man.
Thank you, Fred. Appreciate
thank
you. Love you.
All right, love back. And, folks, that was Fred Brown. Hope you enjoyed it. And as I said, tomorrow, up next in the Coach's Corner, we've got the Dunbar Poets in the house, Timmy Green and Skip Honey Dip Wise. But for right now, I want to thank, as always, my super producer, from the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com, my man, Rick Hampton Sr., and, of course, Horton's Funeral Service, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic Capital Region. And as always, folks, make good decisions, because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid. We'll see you tomorrow. Skip Wise and Timmy Green will visit the Coach's Corner. Love the whip.